Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
On May 23rd...
I want to go back to normal.
What's normal?
The Paramount Plus original series, Evil, returns.
We've already hunted werewolves and demons.
And now what? A baby antichrist?
Okie dokie.
Prepare yourself.
You will not beat us.
For the end.
I have visions of hell.
Make it stop. Make it shut up.
You're not gonna survive this.
Evil, the final season. Streaming May 23rd, only on Paramount Plus.
Everyone is talking about If.
I'm gonna go on a limb here, but I like it. I love it.
It's original and heartfelt.
Ta-da!
And the must-see comedy of the summer that's perfect for the whole family.
This is just so exciting!
If. Rated PG. Now playing in theaters.
Now available in more homes than the Pac-12 Network, we are the Podcast of Champions. I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online.
And here he goes, Miles Jack!
And I'm Ryan Abraham from USCFootball.com.
Liner, gonna try to sneak it ahead. Touchdown, SC!
We are the Podcast of Champions. Welcome, everyone, back to the Podcast of Champions. I am David Woods from Bruin Report Online, the UCLA site on the 24/7 Sports Network.
And I'm Ryan Abraham from USCFootball.com, the USC site on the 24/7 Sports Network. And together we make the Podcast of Champions, talking all things formerly Pac-12 football. We got to talk some Oregon Ducks, probably the most talented team of the former Pac-12 schools going into the Big Ten.
Yeah, does that hurt you to say that?
Does it hurt me?
Like, does it hurt? Like, because
it's been like that case for like years.
I know, but you've got the reps in your brain still of always thinking that's USC.
Oh, that I mean, they've been really good at underachieving with talent, but Oregon's been like, you know, and doing a really good job of keeping talent home. But we're going to talk, we got Matt Prehm here. So we got to talk about the Ducks. We got to talk about the Ducks football team going to the Big Ten. Dylan Gabriel coming in could be lighting it up, the spring game and all that. But we welcome in Matt. Matt, how you doing, man?
Good, guys. How are you guys? Enjoying your spring football? I guess it's over for both all three of us now, right?
Yeah, it's all over.
I've got two more. They did the spring game, and now they're going to have two more practices. One's
and
ongoing right now.
Availability, because Oregon had practice yesterday, but they didn't give us availability.
Interesting. Yeah, two more availabilities, Deshaun Foster, and it's been full viewing too. So we've gotten a full picture of this pretty mediocre team.
So wait, so like, did Chip Kelly have something in his contract as if he leaves, those stupid practices of doing practices after the spring game would still have to go on, even the Deshaun Foster era? Was that part of the contract?
Yeah, it was. It's like the Rose Bowl lease. Like, it's just in place for the next 30 years.
Okay.
UCLA will do anticlimactic practices in perpetuity. They actually already have two scheduled for after the last regular season game, just for funsies.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. Well, we're going to talk about everything going on with Oregon. Let everybody know. You can email us if you have a question, pac12podcast@gmail.com. We got some good ones this week, including another one of why Dave is so stupid. But, you know, it's kind of beating a dead horse. Call or text 424-532-0678. Or you can tweet us at pac12podcast. And leave us those 5-star reviews over on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. We appreciate that. Matt, where do you get your podcast? Where are you? You're not an Apple.
We go mostly iTunes, Spotify. Me personally, I go iTunes.
Okay.
Every once in a while, I'll use Google for whatever reason, but that's where I go. I apologize. Sounds like of all days, someone's doing some yard work at 9:30 in the morning.
No worries.
No, it makes me feel like I'm at home. They've been doing construction on a house next door to me for what feels like 6 years, which is odd because I've moved in that time, but it feels like they've followed.
Yeah, at least you're here. When, when Dave's at home, he also gets the airplanes overhead a lot. So we get that. We get that.
Yeah.
But yeah, thanks again for coming on. We got to talk about everything that's going on with Oregon football. I mentioned it at the top, you know, transfer portal is a big deal. Does the window close today? I think it's closing. Today's the last day.
Today's the last day to enter.
But
you got like 48 hours, right? Yeah. Schools can like, so you know, if you're Matt and you're like a star running back and you tell the Ducks, hey, I'm going to the portal. They have like 48 hours to post it because you get like a cooling off period. So we might hear of more guys entering the portal over the next couple of days. But I think one of the things that Oregon's done a really good job is player retention. We've seen some of the acquisitions, but it seems like, you know, Ducks aren't losing guys that are potential starters, just, you know, maybe guys that are like lower on the depth chart.
Yeah, that's pretty true. It happened the first year when Dan Lanning left. They lost some guys that were in slots to be starters. And then last year they lost a couple guys, but it wasn't nearly as many. And now this season, pretty much anyone that's left has been a player that's simply just not going to play at Oregon. Or it's a younger player that they had a lot of hope and excitement for, but that was going to be in 2025 or in 2026. So they've done a really good job of being able to retain its star talent while also going out and adding more of it. And I think that's probably in large part, you know, in today's day and age, let's just be real. Like, I think Oregon's NIL collective, Division Street, is really good. And they're funded really well. And the University of Oregon's football program takes care of its players for the most part. And guys feel like they're amply compensated.
I do want to share a little bit of information with you, Matt, because I asked you about this going into spring. Somehow, some way, Brian Addison is indeed eligible this season in his seventh year of college football. I'm still trying to unravel the mystery here. But somehow,
we haven't figured it out up here either. We actually talked about that, I think, a week and a half ago, because there was a photo of him on Instagram that kind of went viral in the media. And we're kind of like asking the SID, like, how do you know this? How is this happening? And he had no idea.
Just to take everyone through it really quick, because I think this is important. All right. So he's a 2018 recruit.
Yes.
And he played in four games as a freshman, but that's fine. You can redshirt still. That's totally fine. That's his redshirt year, 2018.
Okay. Yes.
Then he played as a redshirt freshman in 2019, all 14 games. So that's his redshirt freshman year. Then COVID happens. That doesn't matter. Nothing matters. Doesn't count. All right. So 2021, he's a redshirt sophomore, plays in 13 games. 2022, he's a redshirt junior, plays in 12 games. 2023, he played in how many games? Another four?
I think four.
Somehow he's using a second redshirt year.
They're claiming something that happened in 2023 that get him a medical redshirt.
Hardship of some sort.
Oh, and look, the reality is, it's funny because Oregon's kind of doing this too in the basketball program. Their best player in Fale Dante is petitioning to get a waiver from the NCAA because he didn't get an opportunity to play the COVID year, the year that didn't matter. And it's really funny because Mick Cronin, after Oregon eliminated him in the Pac-12 tournament, I think jokingly said, just go sue him because you'll get your year back. Maybe that's what Brian Addison's doing. Like, on the flip side, just you're going to sue the NCAA, you're going to get your year back, you're going to make it up, who cares? And the NCAA has no teeth and they're just going to allow it.
Yeah, no, I think they're just afraid of lawsuits. Anyway, that was just a funny note. What I wanted to hear about, so this was interesting to me because, like, reading about Oregon, because for me, they're an obvious national championship contender this year. Sure. But one of the things that was interesting, and I know the Heisman does not matter, nobody, like, except for Ryan, cares about it in any real way, but Dylan Gabriel put up great numbers last year for Oklahoma, but I saw him not high in the preseason Heisman odds. Like, you can get pretty good value on him. I think he was like plus 6,000.
Yeah.
What was your impression of him this spring, and what do you think he brings to the table, and do you think he can do a pretty close replica of what Bo Nix was able to do last year?
Well, we should note that Dan Lanning he worries a ton about what we get to see in practice.
Okay.
So for most of spring football, we got to see Gabriel flat-footed throw or throw 1 yard passes down the line of scrimmage, like 1 yard deep passes for screens and bubble screens and very minimal throwing. So the real only opportunity we had to see him in action was the spring game. And they decided to split the teams up where the left tackle, the left guard were on one offensive unit.
Oh boy.
And then the center, right guard, right tackle were on the other. And that Oregon's defense is loaded. They have absolute monsters everywhere. Oregon's offensive line is good. They will be a Joe Moore candidate yet again. But just like every other school out there, like you typically have more good defensive linemen than you have offensive linemen. And we saw some advantageous situations for the defense where a starting defensive end was up against a third string offensive tackle. It's unfair to the offensive tackle. It's unfair to judge Dylan Gabriel with the pressures that he had because he normally isn't going to have that. But he did lead the team in passing yards. He did throw 2 touchdown passes. I thought he forced a little bit here and there. He admitted that maybe he got a little too aggressive, but that's kind of the nature of the offense. And that's kind of be the byproduct sometimes. But all in all, like they are really high on him. They think he's going to slide right in. And, you know, you can't say he's going to replace Bo Nix. They're different players. But the expectation is there's no drop off in the level of talent, the level of proficiency that the offense has with Gabriel at QB instead of Bo Nix. If you're a value better, you're trying to find value, absolutely throw some money on Gabriel, because even if there are struggles, look at the schedule that they play to start the year. They're at home against Idaho. They go to Oregon State and they're going to slaughter the Beavers really bad. And then they play Boise State. That's going to be another one. That's going to be just a bloodbath. And then they get a bye week before they go down to UCLA. And the Bruins are probably going to be improved just by pure talent, because it sounds like Deshaun Foster is recruiting, what Chip Kelly didn't. But they shouldn't be on the same level of playing field. And then you get – I think it's Michigan State at home, and they're not going to be the greatest team either. So even if there are growing pains, they've got a schedule that sets them up where they can make some mistakes, and they're not really going to play anybody that's going to be a threat for the first 4 or 5 games of the season.
Looking at that offense a little bit, it seems like the receiver room is really deep. What's it look like at running back with, trying to replace Bucky Irving and maybe some of even like the depth at quarterback, it looks like, you know, with Dante Moore there and some other guys. I mean, it's probably Gabriel's job, right? But it seems like there's a lot of options behind him.
Yeah, at quarterback, I mean, I won't speak for the entire country, but I'd be pretty surprised if there's more than a few teams that have a better overall QB room than Oregon does. They've got one of the best. They've got the guy that's going to be the most experienced quarterback in NCAA history in Gabriel, and then a former number one recruit in Dante Moore backing him up, and then 2 real promising freshman quarterbacks. One's a redshirt, one's a true freshman. And then at running back, you know, Bucky Irving is going to be a big loss. They lost Dante Dowdow to the transfer portal. And that's kind of what I was talking about earlier. Like, very talented player, would not surprise me in the slightest if he goes on to Nebraska and has a great career, very similar to what happened with Trey Benson transferring from Oregon to Florida State. But he had to wait a couple seasons if he wanted to be the guy at Oregon, because they got Noah Whittington back from injury. He was as good as Bucky Irving was. They split carries their first year in 2023. And then in 2024, he got hurt about 4 or 5 games into the season. And will be back now. He's healthy. And then Jordan James, who kind of assumed Noah's role once he got hurt last year, he flourished. Was like a short yardage guy his freshman year in 2023, led the team in rushing touchdowns, and now you know almost ran for, I think, over 800 yards last year. He's probably going to be the starting running back. Whittington will be the Robin to James' Batman. And they added a D2 transfer, Jay Harris, he's a huge kid. He's like 6'2", 230. He definitely is more talented than a typical D2 guy. Someone that should have been on an FBS roster. They're really high on him as well. At receiver, look, I've covered this team since 2009. I've followed it religiously before that. This is maybe as talented of a group on paper that they've ever had. Evan Stewart's a former five-star recruit, potential first-round draft pick. Tez Johnson's getting buzzed as a potential first-round draft pick after this season. Trayshawn Holden was really good for Oregon this past year. Gary Bryant, a transfer from USC, has kind of found his role. And then they've got a bunch of younger guys. Jerrion Dickey's a former five-star. Jeremiah McClellan's a four-star recruit that's really talented. They've got Ryan Pelham, Dylan Gresham that have also kind of forced their way into the mix. Junior Adams, their receiver coach, he typically, whether it was at Washington before Oregon or now here at Oregon, like he typically only plays four, maybe five receivers, in games that are competitive. And once the games get blown out, he'll open the door. But if the game's competitive from start to finish, he really only leans on four or five guys. And that's here at Oregon, and that's also at Washington. And he came out this spring, and Oregon's coach is also, the OC, Will Stein, also said the same thing. Like, they're so talented, they're so deep, they're probably going to have to play a little bit more, some of these guys that are four, five, and six, just because if they don't, they're probably going to lose them because their room is just that talented.
I want to go a little high level because from my perspective, Oregon's obviously an elite program, obviously firing on all cylinders, and obviously a huge step above where it was under Mario Cristobal, who to some extent set the foundation with his recruiting prowess and all that, but obviously not a great in-game coach. But Oregon obviously has lost, I think it's three straight to Washington. The last two games were both by a field goal, but what is the program sense of how Dan Lanning is doing? What's the fan base temperature? Because I know for UCLA, if a guy is really good, but he loses to USC, a lot of fans, I would say lower information fans, but fans nonetheless, are kind of down on that guy just because he lost to USC. What's your sense of the fan base with Lanning, especially respective to Washington, but just general sense of how he's done with the job?
The three Washington losses are all tough because the first one, which happened in 2022, they should have won. They had a goal line stand that they should have kicked the field goal, and they ran a trick play and they turned it over, and coaching mistake growing there. And then at the end of the game, Bo Nix also got hurt. And if they were about to score and there was a snap over his head, and long story short, they lost. They made too many mental mistakes, self-inflicted wounds in that one. And then the second loss to Washington last year, the first one up in Seattle, the game ended with their two starting corners not being able to play because of injury. And then the championship game, their second best defensive lineman got hurt. Nonetheless, those are all excuses. No one wants to hear that. They're 0-3. And you're right there. Even though with all of those losses, you lost, I think, by three or four every time. If they lose a fourth time to Washington, there'll probably be a little bit of some what's going on. This needs to get figured out. You have to be able to beat your rival. But even if they lose, I don't think there's really going to be any kind of growing animosity towards him that maybe he needs to get on the hot seat, or maybe his seat's growing a little warm. Even if they lose that fourth game, which would be pretty damning if he does, because you're kind of at a point where, like, hey, we understand injuries happen. We kind of understand that you're a younger coach. You're starting to go through some growing pains, but it's gotten to the point now where they're just excuses. And no one cares anymore. You got to win no matter what it takes. You have to grow as a coach, and I think he understands that as well. But yeah, there's, if they lose to a fourth time, that would be astronomically bad for the fan base, because they're kind of sick and tired of it. Because it seems like Washington has played above their weight every single time. They play almost perfect football the last two times they've played Oregon. And then they squeak by other teams that are lesser known. And, you know, their Oregon's fan base would be pretty upset if they lost a fourth time.
Yeah, the parallels between the Ducks and the Buckeyes are, I mean, it's that's going to be a great game October 12th in Eugene. But, you know, Ohio State, if not, you know, definitely the most talented team in the Big Ten and then one in the country. I think Oregon's had that distinction the last couple of years in the Pac-12. Now that's going away, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, what happens there. But, you know, not winning the Pac-12 championship either year and not being able to get over on Washington, Ryan Day, not being able to get over on Michigan. Both, you know, coaches are gone, rebuilding the programs a little bit. I mean, Michigan's probably in better shape than Washington that lost 20 of 22 starters or whatever. But I think the parallels there are really interesting. And then the clash between those two, you mentioned the early part of schedule is kind of easy. You know, I'm not sure how Michigan State will be, but the Oregon State game, I mean, the Ohio State game on October 12th will be big. Michigan going to Ann Arbor, you know, going to Madison, Wisconsin, and then, of course, you know, welcoming in the Huskies. Like, the second half of the schedule is going to, you're going to tell a lot, but that that Ohio State game has got to be the one that you were circling in the Big Ten for sure.
I mean, it's a big reason why that they've sold out all their season tickets already. And I asked, like, is there any concern that it's Ohio State fans just buying tickets and then scalping the rest of the year? And they said no. They would have caught that, and none of that has popped up to their radar either. So Ohio State has VPN, and they're amazing at figuring out how to bypass their geolocations when they're buying tickets, or they're all Duck fans. That Ohio State game is going to be big because they were supposed to play in COVID in the 2020 season. And that was when Oregon, with the roster that they had of Penei Sewell, Diomede Lenore, Thomas Graham, Brady Breeze, you know, they brought back like the defensive MVP from the Rose Bowl. You know, they won the Rose Bowl the year before. They had an elite offensive line with maybe the who's maybe now the best offensive tackle in pro football, Penei Sewell back. Javon Holland, who's a star at the NFL level, was going to be entering his junior year on that team. You know, they were going to be absolutely loaded, and Ohio State was going to come to play, and they never actually got to play the game. So there's all that's thrown onto it of the hype and the excitement of like, hey, we're finally getting Ohio State to come to Eugene and play this game. It's probably going to be one of the most anticipated, if not the most anticipated game at Autzen Stadium in a long time. From a non-conference perspective, hands down, it's the biggest one. I guess, yeah, they're still
they're now. It's a conference game.
Yeah, no more. I haven't got to have to get used to that.
No, we never will.
No, it's going to be – it's the anticipation's already brewing for it. But you're right. Like, it doesn't start and end with Ohio State. And this is why it's so important that they've been able to retain – most of their roster. We'll see what happens in the next 48, 72 hours. A couple guys have to leave because they're over 85 right now. But that's why it's been so important. They've been able to establish, develop, and create that depth that they have. And now it's important to showcase it because injuries are going to happen. You're going to have a key guy get hurt. You're going to have a guy who's not going to play as good as expected going into the year. Those things happen. And the idea in this sport is to have as many bullets in your chambers as you can, and Oregon's put a bunch of them in there.
And Oregon has put a bunch in there because recruiting for the last 6 years, I think four of the last six classes have been top 10 classes. This last class was, I think, number four. This is the 247 ratings. And only two of those four have come since NIL's been a thing. So Oregon was already becoming a major recruiting power. But now, as you said, NIL is extremely well funded at Oregon. What because historical perspective on Oregon was always, you know, if they're in a battle with USC, USC's more often than not going to win it. Yep. And, you know, and back in like the mid 2000s, it was sort of like a Washington, Oregon, and UCLA kind of fighting out for the second level. Exactly. Yeah. Now it's that paradigm has completely changed, obviously. But who is it that when Oregon's going up against them, you feel like that school has an upper hand? Because it doesn't seem like too many still do.
No one on the West Coast.
Right.
Probably like an Alabama or a Georgia. I would get worried about Ohio State or Michigan for East Coast and Middle America prospects. Just because the reality is Oregon has improved its facilities. They've improved its coaching. They've improved its facility, its resources, NIL, and they've got the uniforms and they're winning games, but they can't move the program. And you still have to deal with a kid who is coming from Texas and has to realize, oh, I got to get on a 5-hour flight, and that's a direct. Or if I got to connect somewhere, it gets even longer. That's you're never going to be able to circumvent that. And so the further you get away from Oregon, I start worrying a little bit about just the local schools. But like, if they're going after, like, let's use Brandon Dorlus, for example. Like, this was a guy that was from Florida, high 3-star, low 4-star prospect. He didn't really have the Alabama's, the LSU's, the Florida State's offering him scholarships, and he made it to the NFL. And he's a highly productive player. Those types of guys where there's clearly like, hey, this is a dude, but the two, three best teams in college football in that area, Georgia, Alabama, and we'll throw in LSU, aren't really going after him. There's really no fear that Oregon walks into a room and says, we can't get this guy. Ohio State, you know, if it's an Ohio kid, sure. Texas, if it's a Texas kid, yeah, that's going to concern you. But, you know, at this point, the way they're recruiting, the way Dan does not accept failure, they go into any room thinking they're going to get guys. And there's definitely no one west of the Rockies that scares them from a recruiting perspective at all.
This is going to be a really interesting season. What is the fan base feeling like going into Big Ten play? You know, the schedule looks a lot different. We kind of talked to everyone about what the schedule and stuff is looking like. And it's, you know, if you're Arizona State playing in the Big 12, you're like, oh, like UCF, there's like some weird ones like Michigan, Ohio State. Like there's some big time kind of programs here. You said the fan base, you know, the season tickets were sold out and everything, but it does it seem just in general, the fan base is really excited for
the
next chapter.
They're absolutely juiced. They were done with the Pac-12. Honestly, once the two LA schools bolted, they were like, there's no one left that we look at and say, outside of Washington, there are equal. And, you know, from a playing competition standpoint, whether it's in football or basketball, I mean, Arizona's, you know, the peak of basketball out west, but their football program's nowhere near these other four schools. So like they're fired up. I think the expectation is that they're a title contender. They're a team that gets to the Final Four. They get to the championship. You know, that's kind of the talk. I think with a new conference, traveling to new places, traveling long distances for the first time, you know, there's probably going to be an opportunity where they may slip up in a game that they shouldn't. You're moving to a new conference that from a national perspective is viewed from top to bottom as a pretty solid defensive conference. They play physical football. You know, I actually believe all four West Coast teams, their speed's going to be kind of a shock to some of these Big Ten teams. So I think we might see some better success earlier, especially for Washington and UCLA. People aren't talking about them as much, but I think they've got speed that could show up and surprise some teams and win some games with it. But on the flip side, like, how does Oregon adapt playing Michigan State and Ohio State in two straight weeks? That could be that could be difficult to maneuver.
It's like Utah twice or something, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Like that's going to be hard. So it wouldn't surprise me if the expectation is that they win the Big Ten, but they drop two conference games, just because it's a new league, it's new environments, and it's a step up in competition. The Pac-12 is from top to bottom not as good as some of these other conferences.
Well, what people forget about the Big Ten is that there's a whole lot of Indiana in there.
Yes.
You got Indiana, you got Illinois, you got Rutgers. Like, there's a lot of it.
Purdue.
There's Purdue.
Northwestern.
Like, Purdue exists. Everyone forgets that.
Maryland just hired Brian Ferentz as
Maryland exists.
Like, as an offensive analyst. Like, yeah. The guy had the worst offensive coordinator in the history of the sport.
You're
like,
can you come in and make our offense worse, please? people forget that. I think we should get to some questions from the YouTube chat.
Oh, yeah.
We've got a couple here.
I got one here. Yet another Duck fan. How are the Ducks going to handle attrition to get down under the scholarship numbers? It seems like Lanning is more willing than the average bear to go above the limit and cut post-spring.
Oh, yeah. Last year, when they announced their 2023 class in February, I think they were up to like 95 scholarships, and they got down to 84. This year, currently, I think the number right now is right around 86, 87. So that number is going to be much easier to get to. And there's some obvious ones. So I don't think there's really any concern that they're going to get below the 85. Now, what's starting to happen, it's not just Oregon. Schools that have really good NILs, they are starting to present NIL offers where, hey, you're going to get, let's say, tuition and room and board and all that. The scholarship value for the year is $100,000. Let's just throw that out there. We're going to give you $110,000. And NIL money, and you're going to be a walk-on. There's multiple players that we feel like never really confirmed it, but we've heard plenty of rumors that these guys are on the team as walk-ons, but their NIL deals kind of make up the fact that they're not scholarship players anymore.
Crazy.
And then we've got one more from the YouTube chat, A Dog's Life in Portland. On the field, Moore looked about the same level as Novosad. Do you trust what Moore said, that development was his priority, or do you think he'll eventually move on if Gabriel remains the starter?
Look, I think the fact that Novosad looked the same level as Moore is probably a good thing for Novosad, because I thought Dante Moore looked really good. And Dante Moore has made it very clear in the two times that we've spoken to him at media that he's here for the long haul. And that he understands that he may not be the starter in 2024. And he's talked about how, like, he came here specifically, to learn under Will Stein, but to also play with an older quarterback like Dylan Gabriel and
play behind a functional offensive line. No offense, 2023 UCLA.
Yeah, having an offensive line will help. But it would be a pretty big surprise if he bolts because he didn't win the job. Because it's pretty much – everyone kind of knows, like, hey, Gabriel's the guy this season, and then Moore's the front runner next year. But like I said, Novosad looked really good in his spring performance, second on the team in passing yards. He had some mistakes. He did throw the one interception, but he's put on 30 pounds. He's gotten stronger. His arm is a lot his velocity off the for throws is a lot higher than it was last season. Dante Moore is not going to be a shoe-in to just automatically win the job next year. Novosad was an Elite 11 quarterback, a four-star guy, and then they're bringing in Akili Smith Jr., who's potentially going to be an Elite 11. He's another four-star QB. And then Luke Moga runs like a 4.45 40. He's incredibly fast. As a true freshman QB. So they feel like, back to my original comment of, like, I think this QB room might be the best in the country. It's that good. That's how they view it, where Moore's going to have to win out. He's going to be the favorite, no doubt, but he's going to have to win the job. It's just not going to be handed to him.
We got one last one. We'll let you go, Matt. Appreciate your time. Tony says, do you see a stadium expansion at Oregon, or would you have to build a new stadium?
Can it be both? Because
Oregon's got a lot of money. Like, we'll expand this one and build a second one over there just for, like, overflow. We'll put out big screens. Like, you can't, you're not in the actual game, but you're in another stadium to go just watch.
Like, you guys have been, both been to Autzen. And yeah. The thing that, the one thing I think that, that is a letdown is there's literally nothing around it. There's no bars, there's no restaurants, you know, there's not a lot of parking. So like if it was me and I was spending Phil Knight's money, I would redo the other side of the stadium that's not been updated, and that we've heard plenty of talks that it is in the works, that they have plans there. This season selling out might push them to announce it. And it would probably be more of adding a handful of seats, you know, maybe bumping it from 58 to 67, or maybe just under 70. But making the amenities better, making, you know, adding some luxury suites, some boxes, and that type of stuff, and enhancing the stadium, then full scale, like, hey, let's go from 58 to 82. I don't think that would ever happen, but I would like them to see, you know, they've already did some land swaps with the city of Eugene to build a new indoor practice facility. They're going to have two of those. They won't have two stadiums, but they'll have two indoor practice
facilities. Wow. Okay.
So they're building a new indoor, and I wouldn't mind. I think it'd be pretty cool. And I think they should buy some of the land that's around them, that's kind of undeveloped, and turn it into some parking garages, because there is a lack of parking.
Yeah. Parking's kind of a,
and then build some kind of, you know, district area where you can have restaurants, you can have bars, the fans can show up early, they can stay way late after the game, because there's none of that. Like, the thing I liked the most when I went to Ohio State a couple years ago was the walk to the stadium. You had to walk through a couple streets of just pure parties of restaurants and bars and all of that. We've seen that at other places, and that's not really at Autzen. It was originally built on a big gravel plot, and it stayed that way for a really long time, and nothing was built around it. So that's my wish, my dream. But to answer the original question, like, they'll eventually do something, but it's not going to be one where they're going to try and drastically increase the capacity. It will be more of enhancing what's currently there and adding a couple thousand extra seats or so.
Oh, that was a premature applause. I wanted to thank you for coming on, Matt. We appreciate all of the info and stuff. It's definitely going to be a fascinating season. And, you know, just saying things like Oregon, Ohio State is a conference game.
I will never get used to that.
No. Yeah, it's gonna be weird. I want to mention something to you guys. I was looking, trying to see. We didn't talk about the NFL draft, but it was cool to see Bo Nix go as early as he did. And I think it's being with Sean Payton in Denver is cool. I go to the Pac-12. You can't go to Pac-12.com because they don't have that. They have Pac-12.
They never purchased it.
They never did.
So insane.
And I was like, oh, is there a story on players in the draft? You go to sports at the top thing, and I was like, oh, I didn't see, like, they have football up there. You know, I don't see anything on, like, the draft or what's going on here. It's like one of those things where, like you said, the fans are sort of like ready to go.
Here's another one. So we all know just how hard it is to get to the Pac-12 network. The network never really provided free login information to at least multiple SIDs at Oregon, the people that are in charge of running the media relations for that sport. Those people had to go out and subscribe to Comcast or whatever platform that they could get that had the Pac-12 network. When the Big Ten formally announced Oregon and Washington, within like a week, the SIDs all got information of, hey, here's how you, if you don't have our network, here's how you can get it, so that you can actually see the games that you're promoting and see the games that you're having to help media cover, so that you can provide the accurate information. Like, that's what the fan base at Oregon is super excited about. A conference that's correctly run, that knows what they're doing and knows how to promote and tell the stories of their athletes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Agree. Yeah.
It's going to be a brave new world.
Well, thanks so much, Matt. Great. Make sure you go over to Duck Territory and check it all out over on the 24/7 Sports Network. And we appreciate it, man. Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely.
Thanks, right. Matt.
Everyone else, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back and talk some more Pac-12 football, back or formerly Pac-12 football. Back in a minute, everyone.
Every sport has their big, juicy controversy. Boxing has the Mike Tyson ear bite. Cycling has Lance Armstrong. Baseball has its steroid era. Curling has Broomgate. It's a story of broken relationships, houses divided, corporate rivalry, and a performance-enhancing broom.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
Broomgate, available now.
This is Tony Kornheiser's show. I'm Tony. You expected someone else? So what exactly is the show about? I don't know. It's a sports show nominally. Football's over, but we're finally at a point where things matter in college basketball, and baseball season is on deck. Greatest three words in the English language, pitchers and catchers. We have some of the best voices come on and explain what matters or what makes an upset, like Ryan does, 9-8. No, that's not an upset. No, yeah, it is, Bob. And if you're lucky, I might just tell you about my search for discounted sleep pants or my worries about what my dog just ate. Listen on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Survivor 46 is here, and so is On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast, and we have a twist this season. The winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares, will be joining us every week.
We're going behind the scenes of the biggest moments, the how and the why things happen, and the strategy and analysis you can only get from someone like me, a Survivor winner.
Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
All righty, we're back here. Podcast of Champions.
Hello, Ryan.
Hello, David Woods.
How are you?
That's our last remote guest.
Yeah, the next two are just me and you.
Yeah, so we can do those easy, like can anytime.
We? I have to be prepared.
I'm not going out of the country right now, so I'll be okay, so I can still do it. We could do them the same show.
We could.
Or we could split them up. We already did UCLA, so maybe we... Maybe we'll do a USC one.
We didn't do UCLA. I vented about Chip Kelly for an hour.
Yeah, you said it was like, what did you say? The worst coaching hire in the history
of
American sports or global sports?
I did not say that.
Did you say global sports or American sports?
I did not say that on air.
The worst hire.
You keep bringing up something that I did not say on air.
Oh, I thought maybe I just misheard you. I don't know.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. What? Reevaluating. I mean, I would say, like, there was a lot of, obviously, you know, when you hire someone that's never done the job before, all that kind of stuff.
Was it a good process? No. Should it have been done in November? Yes. Arriving at Deshaun Foster, I mean, Deshaun Foster wouldn't have been looked at by any other school. That being said, he's doing, I mean, look, it
seems like he's doing a pretty good job.
Well, it's the end of April. Who knows?
Right.
There's been no games played, no anything. But like the minimum benchmarks that you need to hit to be a successful program, they're actually doing them. Like having a spring game that, okay, this is like low-hanging fruit marketing opportunity. You know my opinion on spring games. They're useless. They're stupid. But not having one or treating it like something where it's an opportunity to get your fan base out there just so you can point at them and say, fuck you, like Chip Kelly did, where he would host spring games at 8 or 9 in the morning at Drake Stadium with absolutely nothing else, just a couple of food stands and
yeah.
And then the players doing the worst practice you've ever seen. Instead, they did it at the Rose Bowl.
Deshaun Foster's like, hey, we could bring recruits in.
Yeah, there's
like,
inflatable.
Oh, do that.
And like, also, know? Like, you know, I'm the last time I went to a spring game at the Rose Bowl, I had a 2-year-old. Now I've got a 10 and 7-year-old. I was like, they've got inflatables, they've got games and stuff. I'm like, oh, I could have brought them, and they would have had a good time. So like, there's that, like, where it's just okay. Spring game useless for so many different reasons, but as like an opportunity to inculcate young fans in like. Hey, this is an opportunity to come out and check out UCLA, and it's not going to feel like, you know, as crazy as a football game day atmosphere. It's going to feel like, yeah, this is like a fun and games carnival thing. This is fun. And then they might want to go to a game at some point in the future, like a real one.
Yeah.
But all that shit. So he's doing that, and he's also recruiting. Like, they're actually recruiting. And are they recruiting like Oregon is right now? No, but they're recruiting. Like they're actually doing that aspect of the job.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean they're hitting the benchmarks that you need to hit to be a successful program. Obviously, the main one is winning games, and I don't think anyone should have real expectations about this season. But like, look competent out there. Like, you know, run an offense that looks decent, run a defense that looks decent, and people should be able to see the talent deficiencies, win a few games.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Colt was saying he wants another rant. A lot of people are saying they want another rant, and that Colt said your broadcast has been a little too friendly lately. So, Well, I'll try to bring out some of the hate of David and get some
just stuff. You just got to bring up Chip Kelly.
You could do that. Yeah. One of my favorite coaches ever. Him and Rick Neuheisel. Love those guys. We'll do probably USC next week, and then we'll kind of cap it off with UCLA. We'll get some David rants and stuff going on. Kind of in the world. So we had the NFL draft.
Did we have it?
Yeah. That was a thing that happened.
Who won?
Michigan won by the most schools. But, you know, so it's funny when you look at – so who had the most picks? Michigan. Playoff national championship. Texas. Playoff national championship. Alabama. I mean, not national championship. Playoff. Florida State. Got screwed out of the playoff. Washington. Playoff. Played for the national championship. Pretty good. And who's after
now,
that?
Now, do we think – I've always had this – how much of that is real and how much of it is confirmation bias?
That's a good point. You know, it's a lot easier to draft a bunch of Georgia players when you see, you know,
when you see Georgia competing at the highest level.
Yeah,
yeah.
Pac-12 wise, Washington did really well. That Chris Peterson 2019 class, plus some of the transfers they brought in. What did you have thoughts on Michael Penix going number 8 to Atlanta after they already signed?
I only have thoughts I read because I don't. Follow or care about the NFL, but
they literally signed Kirk Cousins to a 4-year.
They signed they signed a quarterback to a $100+ million deal.
180, I think.
180,
but 100 guaranteed.
100 guaranteed. He has not yet taken a snap for Atlanta, I believe.
No. He got injured late last year, so he's coming off an injury.
Yeah.
And Michael Penix is going to be 24. Like,
and Michael Penix, people are getting hung up on the age. I'm not so worried about that, but why? Why take another quarterback? Because you've got a salary cap. It's not like Oregon stacking quarterbacks. You actually have a cap on this thing.
Yeah.
So why are you spending so much of your cap on two quarterbacks? Is there a different system they're going to run with two quarterbacks out there?
No, it's – so with Penix, if you do get the rookie quarterback who's good, so like Brock Purdy, you get him with the last pick, you know, Mr. Irrelevant, and for his first deal – you get the cheap quarterback. So Patrick Mahomes was that way.
It's not that cheap in the first round.
No, you're still – it's still pretty cheap. Comparatively, it's cheap. And
it's not Brock Purdy. Brock Purdy was what, a sixth-round pick?
He's like, you know, league minimum kind of stuff. But like even Patrick Mahomes, you got him super cheap, and he was like one of the best players in the league. And then when his next contract comes up, now you got to pay him a ton of money. And that, you know, that makes sense. But you usually do one or the other. You're really like, we have a really good team. We can build around this rookie, get him cheap, and we can spend money on other positions. Or we go spend a bunch of money on a veteran, and then, you know, you have to kind of skimp other places. For them to do both, and I think the parallel they were trying to make was what Green Bay did, because they got Aaron Rodgers. He sat on the bench for 3 years while Brett Favre was there, and then they got Love, and he was on the bench for 3 years till they got rid of Rodgers. But those guys weren't top 10 picks. Like, that's the other problem, is like you signed a big free agent and then you used a top 10 pick that you could have got, you know, any, like a difference maker. You had, you know, an opportunity to get a difference maker at number 8, and now you got a bench guy, you know. So Kirk, if you're Cousins, you're like, hey dude, you signed me, like, and he was surprised. So, you know, maybe it works out, and you know, but I think in that situation, you went with the veteran. You could have traded back and probably got Penix later. I don't know. I mean, the fact that Bo Nix went 12, maybe not. You had six quarterbacks go in the top 15, 16 picks, whatever it was.
Yeah, but how much of that? I mean, so people always talk about fucking the NFL draft like it's this goddamn science, and it's fucking not. It's the same dumb shit you see everywhere else. There was a run on quarterbacks, but how much of that was caused by Atlanta picking this fucking guy at number 8?
Yeah.
Like, take Atlanta out of the equation. That's way overvalued for Penix. Like,
probably.
He's a good quarterback. He's somebody, like Aaron Rodgers and Jordan Love of yesteryear, you take at the end of the first round. But like you said, you could probably have traded out of that spot. Suddenly there's not a run on quarterbacks. Suddenly everyone's like, oh, okay, well, Penix and Nix are both still around, so I feel okay. And they can take them in their appropriate spot. But these guys are all emotional, and it's all stupid. It's the same stupid shit everyone else does in every walk of life. It's not some science. It's not some grand experiment where they're like, oh, I know exactly the like order and the you know, if this happens, I'm going to do this. No, it's, oh, God. Oh, God. That's how you end up with 14 offensive players taken before a single defensive player. Because everyone's like, oh, the theme of this draft is offense, so we better get our offensive guys now because there's so many offensive. No, shut the fuck up. Like, shut the fuck up. Take Leatu Latu at number 8, and you'll have a better team than if you'd taken your stupid quarterback.
I mean,
then.
Brock Bowers could be a difference maker.
It doesn't matter. Like anybody.
Roma Dunze. Like, you
there's so many guys who are going to be stars in the league who are taken between, I don't know, the mid-first and the mid-sixth that could have been taken higher.
Wouldn't Cousins have liked Roma Dunze, who went the very next pick?
It's stupid people who get worried and under pressure. And it's not even stupid people. I shouldn't be that unfair. It's just people. People behave stupidly when they're under pressure. The NFL draft is highly pressurized. It's become more highly pressurized because it's become this televised event that everyone watches.
It's huge. There was three quarters of a million people.
Like a GM.
In Detroit. Like outside watching this stuff.
As a GM or a president of football operations or whoever's making the pick. As a GM, you got your fan base mad at you most of the season for various things you've done. But there is nothing that puts you under the spotlight that, like those, what is it, 15 minutes, 10 minutes where you're on the clock?
Yeah, the first round, I think, is
10 or 15 minutes.
10, and then it goes down.
But there's nothing more probably excruciating for these guys than having those 10 minutes where everyone, so you have the 10 minutes where you're on the clock where they're all like, oh, they better do this, this is this. Then you make your pick, and then there's 10 minutes to wait until the next pick is taken. And in those 10 minutes, you are getting the hardest criticism you've ever gotten in your life. And you want to avoid that. But you also don't really know what you're doing. And there's so many things that go into it. Like, it's not a hard job. Like, it's shit that everyone does on their video games. But it is pressurized. And so stupid decisions get made all the fucking time. And people talk about this like it's, you know, putting together the atomic bomb. It's not. It's mostly just people who are, you know, haven't played enough video games.
I think there's that saying of like, you know, you're playing chess, not checkers or whatever. And I think we give too many people credit for playing chess. Like,
no one is playing chess. They're all playing checkers. Some of them are better at checkers than others, but it's all checkers.
The NFL teams, I believe, can bring in like 30 or 32 players to their facility.
Yeah.
Michael Penix wasn't one of them. Like, they had meetings and stuff, but he didn't get brought to, like, so it wasn't like, oh, man, we really liked him from the, you know, it was one of those things where it was like a target of opportunity or something. You know, if they really thought it through, they probably wouldn't have signed Cousins. It just, sometimes you just have to look at it. It's like, yeah, you know, it might work out, but the process is flawed. You know, there's some bad decisions were made. Like, ideally you wouldn't be doing this.
Well, there's,
you know,
the analogy for me, and not to get too college football centric, but like guys like Chip Kelly, right, who are trying to invent a new mousetrap all the time. And it's this combination of Dunning-Kruger, where you have reached beyond your level of competence, and almost all of these guys have. And then also this profound ego, which kind of goes hand in hand with the Dunning-Kruger, where it's just blind to all of your flaws and all of this stuff, and just this rejection of simplicity. Because if you're running an NFL team, it should be obvious at the end of the year what you need, right? Like, oh, we had no pass rush. We need an edge. We had really poor tackling. We need a middle linebacker. Our pass coverage was horrible despite having a decent pass rush. We need a corner. whatever. We need a quarterback should be the most obvious thing in sports, right? Our guy, he can't make the throws that need to be made.
You need to have a quarterback.
But at the NFL level, that analysis should be easier than it is at the college level because there's so many pieces of a team that are at the highest level of talent because you're at the NFL level, right? And yeah, there's some confirmation bias that goes into this and yada, yada, yada. But for the most part, you're looking at elite players at so many spots. So when there isn't one, you should be able to identify it really quickly. So,
and the replacement should be easier because these are already grown men as opposed to like a 17-year-old trying to replace.
So you've got this. You have this understanding that, okay, we need an edge. We need a wide receiver. We need a quarterback. And then you look at it and you say, which one of these is the most important one we need? And it's, okay, we need a quarterback. Okay, then if you need a quarterback and that's a desperate need, then you need to get into the top 15 of the draft so you can get a good one, right? So you trade some shit to get it. Quarterback's the most important position on the team. That's easy. But if that's not the most important one, if it's just a need, then you don't do that because the most important need should be the one that you focus on. And if it's an edge or if it's a wide receiver, what we've learned is that NFL draft is stupid. You can probably get that wherever you're going to get it. But they get scared and then they're like, oh, but there's a great opportunity to get this guy. And it's like, well, that opportunity doesn't matter to you. And also you might be thinking, oh, we'll get him and then he's a trade asset in the future. Nobody's going to do that for you because they can look at your roster as easily as you can. And they know that you're desperate to get rid of him because he's not going to play.
Right.
So you're not getting value for him. You dumb shit. So don't do that.
Matt Flynn, Dog's Life in Portland pointed out that Matt Flynn signed a month before with Seattle, before they signed, drafted Russell Wilson in the third round. But again, it's like you didn't use a high pick on Russell Wilson. And I think there's a different era, but Matt Flynn's guaranteed money was like $10 million, not $100 million. So it's
I think
that high of a pick is the biggest issue
I have.
And
they might have taken Russell Wilson in the third round thinking, oh, he'll play behind Matt Flynn for a year or two, and he picked up shit a lot faster than they thought he would. I mean, that stuff is defensible. It's just – but I'm sure that Seattle's done stupid shit in the first round too.
Yeah.
Because guys get scared, and they're like, what do we do? I don't know what to do. Take Leatu Latu. Be happy with yourself.
Yeah. Washington had 10 players selected. Oregon had 8. USC had 7. Utah had 5. And then going down, Arizona had 3. Oregon State had 3. Washington State had 3. And who else do we got here? UCLA had 2. Mm-hmm. I think that was all the ones that I had written down. I think, was it Arizona State and Colorado the only ones that didn't have any players selected?
That feels right.
Colorado hasn't had a player selected since 2021. Arizona State was 2013. And then if you want to talk about squandering talent, I think Brett McMurphy tweeted this out. NFL draft picks from the teams that finished the season unranked. Number one, USC with 7. Utah didn't finish ranked. They had 5. So 2 Pac-12 teams kind of made that.
So one list. Devastated by injuries, one devastated by Alex Grinch.
Yes, that was. And then the funny thing being that the Pac-12, you know, the SEC had the most. They had 59 players selected. But the Pac-12 had 43, and that was the most that we've seen in this era, the 7-round Pac-12 era since, 2015 they had 39, but this was the most. So sort of the high water mark on the way out the door. But if you look at the schools that are going to be in the Power 2, the SEC or the Big 10, they had 140 draft picks. 55.5% of the draft would go to those two conferences. So kind of crazy. We see like sort of the group of 5 kind of go up and down. FCS can, you know, have like double digit draft picks or only have a couple. It just depends. But with the portal, like a lot of those seniors that would have been at like Miami of Ohio or North Dakota State, like, and they would get drafted, they're probably going to be at like Alabama or Ohio State or something going forward. So you might not see as many of those lower teams drafted because they can, you know, those programs getting draft picks because that senior year, maybe they go 3 years and they want to go play for a big time program and those schools are taking them and then they'll get drafted by the power, you know, two school as opposed to the group of five or the FCS school.
Yeah.
Pretty nuts. The other thing, just you know, Ross Dellinger does a great job reporting this stuff, and I know Pete Thamel tweeted about it and stuff too. I haven't dug into it a whole lot yet, but we are – the landscape is changing. I was just at a House of Victory, did like a Legends of Troy event last night where they had a bunch of former players, and they invited some media, so we went down there, and it was cool to see. You know, they're basically raising money from donors and trying to get former players involved, like all schools are doing, trying to get – to build up that war chest or whatever to pay name, image, and likeness money to college athletes, mostly, you know, football, but they're doing other sports as well. But one step, the next step will be paying athletes in-house instead of through collectives. And it looks like, you know, there's a, that the case with the House and the NCAA, where there's a suit about paying back money for NIL for the last few years that players didn't get an opportunity to make money off their name, image, and likeness. They're trying to come up with some sort of settlement. And basically it would, from what I've been reading, David, get your thoughts, the end of amateurism, where schools would be able to pay these athletes. And I don't know if it would cross the employee boundary or not, but, you know, being basically bringing those collectives sort of in-house. One of the proposals would be there's a lot of back money paid, like I think $1 billion paid for, you know, not paying these athletes before, but then going forward, having some sort of like salary cap where $15 to $20 million every school can pay. And then you could have people going around that anyway. But I mean, that would be kind of interesting, but there's Title IX issues. There's a lot of kind of issues in all the presidents. I mean, you got to get a majority of presidents to kind of vote on this. And it sounds kind of crazy, but if you were thinking that, you know, employees, athletes or employees from the schools is like 10 years away, it could be like 10 months away, or, you know, in-house paying of athletes and the end of amateurism as we know it. It's not 10 years away. It's closer to 10 months away. But I don't know what your thoughts on this whole thing is.
Yeah, I mean, the end of amateurism is already – I mean, it's – I don't know. I mean, from like a actual like literal definition of the word, I mean, it's pretty much already gone.
Yeah.
And it's been gone for a while now. I mean, we got to see how the cookie crumbles with how all of this is going to work. If that lawsuit, you know, if they don't reach a settlement, it could be devastating enough that it ends – the NCAA and ends college athletics as we know it, but the settlement will as well. And I think there's a bright future possible for college athletics if the right deals are struck. But I think there's a reality to all of this that if you want college athletics as it was in any real way, there needs to be a reality check for everybody involved. Coaches need to make a lot less money. The schools need to distribute a good amount to the players, but the players look, NIL deals where you're making like some of these guys are $1 million a year. If you're doing anything that's going to provide sustainability for the sport, that probably can't happen either. Like there needs to be a real understanding that this stuff needs to kind of not balance out. I don't think everyone needs to be making the same wage. But if you want the have-nots to be able to play against your haves ever, then there needs to be some sort of revenue sharing as well. There's a lot to figure out. Like, I liked that proposal from the stupid, what was that group called that did it like 2 weeks ago and everyone shit on it?
What was that called?
Where they did like 70 teams and 10 team leagues.
Yeah.
It was poorly done and it was poorly thought out. But that general idea I liked.
Yeah, you want the geographic element.
Well, and also keeping some teams alive for the purpose of having that geographical element, which is the whole – I mean, people are – I mean, we're talking about the Big Ten and it's all fine, whatever, but that stuff's not going to work in the long term. But there's just – I mean, there's a lot that needs to be figured out. But, yeah, I mean, amateurism is coming to an end here very shortly, and there's going to be some form of paying players directly from the schools, What form exactly that takes, I think, is still to be determined, no matter what they've decided with their settlement.
Yeah. Proposal. I mean, I think it's hard to get everybody sort of on board. And again, it's one of the situations where if you had a czar commissioner of college football, you know, that would make a lot more sense. And, you know, just everyone's like, well, the SEC wants to do what's best for them, and the Big Ten's going to do what's best for them, and other programs are going to do what's best for them to just keep them alive. And, how, you know, how is this all going to work? So kind of follow along with that, but there's been some kind of developments there. But it's going to happen sooner rather than later. It's not like a, you know, down the road where, like, it's, you know, next year, the year after, like, all this stuff is changing pretty fast. We haven't even seen, like, an expanded playoff yet. And just, like, things are changing.
Yep.
Let's do a couple questions. Colt in the chat. By the way, if you're in the YouTube chat watching us live or watching the replay, thank you so much. Appreciate you. It's always fun to have instant fan interaction while we're doing the show, so thank you for that. Colt says, will Foster start recruiting kickers and punters again? UCLA used to be excellent when it came to specialists. Can we get back to that and not worry about a 30-yard field goal?
I think so. I think as it stands right now is they need such immediate help that they're trying to get transfers in for those positions. But I think in the – so right now they've got the Cal transfer who should be good at kicker. And he's a multi-year guy. I think what I would like to see is UCLA, same as they did traditionally, every 3 years recruit another scholarship kicker to learn for a year under the previous one. Because that allows them to build the necessary strength and, like, get into – because, like, high school kicking training is pretty good, and Chris Saylor and all those guys do a pretty good job of training. But it's a different deal when you get into a college program, learning, like, okay, how do I build my distance? How do I, you know, build my core strength? All that kind of stuff that can be done a little bit easier in a college program. So it's good to get those guys in a year early so they're a redshirt freshman and then they get their 4 years. So, but I think they need to kind of stabilize right now. So I do think they're going to start recruiting the position, but I think it might take a couple years here before they really get after it.
There's some little breaking news, I guess. Bruno Fina is in the portal.
That's what I've been writing for the last few minutes.
Oh, is he like good?
He was their starting left tackle last year, but no. No, the answer is he was not good.
Starting left tackle, but not good. Yeah, that's not
he was. So they UCLA picked up a couple of transfers, offensive linemen, one of whom is going to be the starting left tackle next year, Ruben Unije. And Bruno Fina had been moved to right guard in spring, but they also are bringing in another guard who's more than likely going to be the starting right guard in the fall. So Bruno Fina was probably going to be a backup this year. So he'll enter the portal. I think he's probably good enough that he can find a spot at an FBS school still. But yeah, I mean, it was a desperation thing that he was starting last year, and a Chip Kelly thing.
Okay. Do you want to read the David Stupor one? Do you want me to do that? Like, would you rather?
Can you read it? Because I got to tweet this, but I will gladly respond to the David.
So this is from Will. And the subject, I 100% approve, Dave is stupid. Mm-hmm. The majority of the women that graduate from high school across Sunset from UCLA, Marymount High School, are debutantes. Look at cotillions all over LA to find future debutantes. So this was about your kind of rant about, well, this was, we're talking about the LA Times story.
Will's making a stupid point here. So his point, if I'm to distill it to its logical forms, is that because debutantes exist in the West, they are a familiar concept to people in the West, which is of course not true. I think if we did a straw poll of the chat, who knew what a debutante was, we would find that, you know, the actual definition that it's a woman being debuted and introduced to society, probably very small.
Yeah.
Probably not many. So my point, Will, is that it is a more familiar concept in the South, where Monsieur Ben Bolch is from, than it is here. I'm going to talk slowly. than it is here in Southern California, where many people aren't even familiar that Marymount High School exists. And instead, when you say Marymount, we'll think, does he mean Loyola Marymount? Mm. So maybe you have knowledge of a thing that other people generally do not. Consider that.
Nice.
Going forward.
All right. Did you tweet your thing?
Yes, I've tweeted it.
You can do Frank if you want.
Sure.
Unless you want me to do it too.
No, I'd love to. I'd love to read. Women's basketball. This is from Frank in Sacramento.
Yeah.
This past season, the LA Times would report on USC and UCLA basketball without first stating in the headline whether it was a story about the women's teams or the men teams. Since I read the LA Times online, I would sometimes get into an article and then discover it was the version of the sport which I was not interested. This is a huge change for the LA Times as we begin to better self-interrogate. But is it also the kind of thing up with which you will not put? Frank in Sacramento. This is a great point, Frank. I do think that stuff should be clearly delineated for clarity's sake. I think there is this balancing that a lot of publications try to do to help. So there's this idea of uplifting women's basketball. You heard if you were watching the NCAA tournament, it was a lot of like, we're trying to lift up our sport and all this kind of stuff. And that's all well and good. But I think it's not journalists' job to do that. Now, I think journalists have failed in some ways in not covering the sport at the level it probably should be covered.
Yeah.
But it's not journalists' job to do that. Journalists' job is to clarify and provide information for people. If it's unclear, and sometimes the names are not very clear on whether it's men's or women's until you get three or four paragraphs into the story. And it's not a equity thing. It's a confusion thing. Clarify what sport you're talking about, especially if they're both round ball sports. I mean, this is kind of stuff that I think in the interest of being inclusive and equitable and all that good stuff, you lose the main mission of the thing you're doing, which is clarify, remove confusion, provide clear information, provide clear, concise analysis, all that kind of stuff. If you're doing that, you're serving two masters, but you're serving one that isn't as important to your mission as the other.
Okay. So you don't like women's sports.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I took out.
Yeah, yeah. That. No, obviously.
But it's funny, like even so when I was looking at some of that stuff, when in March, and the Pac-12 women were doing like way better. Like I cared more about like what was going on. Oh, is UCLA going to get a one seed or Stanford or USC? Like, you know, there wasn't any kind of that in the, there was more just like, hey, how many teams is the men going to get in the NCAA tournament? So like there was more sort of bigger stories around the women's because they were doing a lot better than what the men were
doing. Yeah, and if you're going to cover both, I think...
But I like both. You don't like the women's, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. If you're going to cover both, and this is where like a lot of people say, well, you don't clarify whether it's a men's story when you write about it. And I'm like, well, if you're going to cover both, you should. And if both draw interest, then you absolutely should clarify in the headline which sport you're talking about. Like it's not that difficult.
No. We got a chat question from Alex. Assuming this year is rough results-wise on the field, how does any coach keep the good vibes going once losses start? What did Fish do right during a one-win year, to keep the fan base?
It's not as hard as you'd think. I think if they look bad and it's horrible, you could have issues, but I don't. If you keep recruiting, it is easy to say in your first year, well, I'm trying to make this happen with, you know, I'm trying to make chicken salad out of chicken shit right now, and it's hard. I need you to plug into that spot. And that's easy to say. Year one. You don't get two mulligans. It's much harder to pitch that in year two than it is year one. But year one, I mean, unless you are devastatingly bad and it's a joke and it's absolutely awful and like, wow, they're not even playing football bad. But Jed Fish in year one, they won one game. But if you remember us talking about it on the show, they were close in a lot of other games.
Yeah.
It was an unlucky 1-win year. It should have been like a 3-9 or a 4-8. It was a 1-11 instead. I think Deshaun Foster is going to do better than that. I think UCLA is good enough, and their schedule is, you know, there's some tough ones in there, but there are three or four wins like that you should not feel too weird about. If they go 4-8, you can sell the crap out of that. You can say, well, we went 4-8 and look at what we didn't have. We didn't have that. We didn't have that. We didn't have that. And you are the guy to fill that. That stuff's easy. It's not that hard. I think for the fan base, I think the problem is it's been 9 years of pretty much dog shit, not like just nonstop for UCLA. I don't know how much patience the UCLA fan base has. I think obviously a year, but that's why I'm trying to, you know, I'm all cards on the table. I'm trying to appropriately set expectations too, because I think the problem is the fan base is very tired of dog shit for 9 years.
Yeah.
And so getting them to be patient as this, whatever this is. And look, Deshaun Foster might not work out. Nobody has a crystal ball. Frankly, you know, he hasn't done this before. So odds are, you know, stacked against him to a large extent. But they're doing a lot of the right things. So you got to give him time. And at worst, I was saying this to somebody at the Rose Bowl on Saturday. Rick Neuheisel, who much loathed, but he gave a shit. Like, he gave a shit about the job, cared about it, wasn't good at it, but he cared about it. He left it in a much better position than the one he inherited from Carl Durrell. Like, what Jim Mora inherited from a talent perspective was far different from what Rick Neuheisel inherited from Carl Durrell. Deshaun Foster, whether he works or not, whether it's good or not, he gives a shit.
Yes.
He's going to get it into a better position than it was from Chip Kelly. It's going to be there. And whether it's Deshaun Foster who takes advantage of that or the next guy, I think we're going to see some growth in the talent level and a better logistical framework for UCLA to actually succeed in this new world of college football at the, you know, 2 or 3 years into his tenure than it is right now.
Yeah. One thing I want to clarify. So always remember this. Hope is not a plan, right? You can't, I really hope, you know, that my team can win the Super Bowl. It's like, well, did they make a whole bunch of dumb decisions? Like, that's just because you're hoping that doesn't mean you need to have a plan. But hope can bring people together. Hope can give people interest in a rebuilding project. And it doesn't have to be a perfect plan where you're like, here's what's going to happen. Just like David said, just having your head coach giving a shit is enough to give you some hope. There's a lot of things that Deshaun Foster is going to do that will give you hope. Now, it's a different level. Can you look at it on the surface and say, yeah, he's never done this before and all that? That's fine. Different kind of hope, like was in Colorado. You hire, you know, one of the best to ever do it. So much hype around him. Deion Sanders, YouTube channels. Like, that gave everyone hope. And even this year, where, like, the whole roster is getting kind of redone again, it's just churn. There's still, you talk to Colorado people, and there's still a lot of hope, you know, after winning, losing 8 of your last 9 or whatever it was last year. There's still a lot of hope there. They fall on their face again. I still think he's got enough hype that there'll still be hope. You know, like, if he sticks around.
Hope is the absolute essential lifeblood of a program. As you said, it's not a plan.
Yes.
But it is the essential piece of the puzzle, because that's what keeps fans coming back. It's what keeps tickets being sold. It's what keeps recruiting happening. All of this stuff, hope is essential. Your fan base needs to hope. If they don't have hope, and this is, I mean, we talked about this in the fall when they weren't firing Chip Kelly. It's like,
yeah,
you are giving in to the reality of hopelessness. Like, you are giving in,
yeah,
but like at a very real level, you are taking away the possibility of this working out, which means that fans are going to walk away. They're done, because you are cynically telling them, fuck you.
Yeah.
And fuck your hope and fuck your dreams and fuck everything. Like, they're basically calling out the reality of sports as this construct in real time, where they're like, sports don't matter. Fuck you. And people want the make-believe. They want to feel like this inspiring joy in their breast from this stupid thing that happens parasocially, where you have like no connection to it aside from you maybe went to that school or rooted for it when you were young, but these 18 to 22 year olds doing this out on the field leaves you feeling better than you feel, you know, doing anything else.
Yeah.
You want that. You want that escape. You want that shit. And if you call out the reality of it and say, well, we make enough money that it doesn't really matter what you people do, you're doing something awful and cynical. Like, it's a very bad thing to do, people, to remove their hope. Yeah. So what UCLA decided to do with retaining Chip Kelly in the fall, awful. What Deshaun Foster is doing so far, breathing hope into the fan base. Whether it works or not, is who cares? But 11,000 people showed up to the Rose Bowl, and that's about, I don't know, 4.5 times more than showed up to Drake Stadium last year for the spring game. So there's people who still want to come to this shit. There's people who still want to pay for tickets. There's people who still want to go to the games. And if it's good, and if you don't feel like you're an interloper when you come, and you don't feel unwelcome, and you don't feel like there's somebody there who's in charge of the whole thing who would prefer it if you just died, then maybe this thing will actually work.
Hope is funny. In our sport, it's just a big part of it, because recruiting has been such a big part of what we do. Like, when we're covering college athletics, recruiting, the off-season stuff, that it's almost more important to some of the fans. Like, I remember, you know, when we were able to cover summer workout. So players would sign, there'd be recruiting class, people really cared, like, who's USC getting, blah, 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 blah. Well, we got to see them work out in the summer, like, doing player run practices and all that kind of stuff. And I would take pictures and tell them, like, hey, here's that 4-star, you know, safety you talked about. And a lot of fans were sort of like, they've already moved on. Like, oh, they're on the team now. Who's the next guy going to be? Like, the thing that you don't know, it's like you want that buildup, the hope of yeah. that happening. Just look at, you know, Michigan won the national title last year. It's not like they win them all the time. There's more hope at Ohio State, who's lost to Michigan year after year because of the crazy offseason they had. And, you know, you could debate, would you rather be like the defending national champion or Ohio State that's like building like a super team, what it looks like, you know, and getting all, you know, these players from all over the place. That hope is almost like more important than the actual results. We talk about Oregon, like, hey, Oregon's got the more talented team. It's like, oh, you know, Washington's this afterthought that keeps beating them over and over again. So it's just kind of a weird aspect of our sport.
Yeah, but it's an aspect of every sport. Like, I think
more so in college. I mean,
college athletics for sure. But like, I don't know. I mean, I think the thing that keeps you coming back to any of this stuff is just you know, this rational or irrational belief that, hey, maybe this will work out. And what it like looks like. I mean, we've been trying to tamp down expectations for this year a lot on our message board and on our site. But I still think people are hopeful. They're not hopeful that it's going to be like a 10-win season, but they're hopeful about the trajectory. They're hopeful about this kind of unknowable future, this the long horizon or whatever it is. And that's the piece that I just, you know, I mean, when I don't know. Chip Kelly treating this all contemptuously and then UCLA aiding and abetting him for years is just – I don't know. It's revolting. It's cynical, and it's a bunch of people who just do not get it. Like, who did not get it, did not understand what the point of all this is.
Yeah, I think we got one more. You want to do this last one?
Sure.
International, like.
This is from Ben. Hi, Ryan and Dave, future Pac-2 teams. It wasn't enough that your country steals all of our tech talent. This is from Canada. But now you're stealing our homegrown linemen as well. I'm referring to Giovanni Manu from the UBC Thunderbirds, drafted in the 4th round by the Detroit Lions. Mm. Does this open the possibility of the Pac-2 expanding north of the border? Imagine all those views and untapped markets. Dave will probably clown me for my Canadian English again. Yours politely, and still the only former Pac-12 fan from Toronto. I don't think he used any Canadian language there. I think it was all pure American English.
Yeah, homegrown. Like, I'm trying to see what is there a phrase that is Canadian only? I don't know. I didn't see anything from the email. Maybe the future Pac-2 could have some Canadian flair. You know, it's Canada. That's America's hat.
Don't
right?
they play like love it. They play Canadian football up there? Isn't it played with like a baseball and you swing a bat and shit? And I don't know.
Yeah, you have to. There's maple syrup. Like you don't flip a coin.
Isn't there a quaffle?
instead of helmets,
do you have to find the snitch?
Yeah.
Is there a mallet involved? I can't remember.
I think it's something like that. Yeah.
What shape is the ball?
The football is a weird
is
shape.
Is it a triangle?
Yeah. Do you like colored money? Do you like just greenbacks?
What a question. No, colored money looks too much like Monopoly money to me.
Yeah, that's, you know.
That's the problem. Also, a lot of them print it on not very high quality like linen stuff, so it actually feels like Monopoly money too.
Mm. If you buy like Canadian Monopoly, does it have all green bills or are they different colors too?
It's got to be different colors.
I was just saying.
Otherwise, how would you differentiate it so quickly?
But you don't want to mix it up with like actual Canadian money, so you just make it look like more American money, make it all green.
I guess that's true. I guess that's true. I don't know.
I don't know.
It's a tough one. Yeah. Greenbacks.
You're a greenback guy.
Yeah. Do it American.
American style.
American.
We got to figure out the coin thing. Because you go to other countries, sometimes you have like a coin that's worth like $5, you know, that's like commonly used. So you're like, oh, when you're like traveling somewhere, you're like, you have a handful of coins. It could be worth, you know, a hundredth of a penny or $5. You're not sure, like there's, you know, mixing up things there. We probably should get rid of coins at some point. You think?
Yeah. I mean, they're kind of fun. It's kind of cool to have coins. But once we jumped off the gold standard, I don't know. I mean, you don't really need, like back in the day, like a coin also was like the weight of its gold or whatever. Like, no, it actually like had like its inherent value baked into the whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, if you have like 1960 something quarters, like they're actual silver and like that's worth more money than what the.
I kind of feel like if we went away from coins though, either everything goes all electronic or everything goes up in price. Like you're gonna sacrifice those pennies or those nickels.
Amy says we need to get rid of pennies. I would be okay with that.
Yeah, but if you there's some, isn't there a great racket you can do with pennies and their copper that if you can find like the right thing, pennies? They're actually worth more money as their constituent metals than the representative penny.
Probably a good reason to get rid of them too.
Oh, you mean fraud?
Yeah.
And debasing our currency. Yeah, probably.
You know what? I'll do a quick little rant. Like, I have an electric car now, so I don't usually go to the gas station. The 9/10 thing has to fucking go. Like, stop with the 9/10. Like, I get you want to say a $5 thing is $4.99. Your brain says it's four something, not five. The 9/10 is just fucking ridiculous. Get rid of it. I don't know where it came from. Maybe there's some reason. Someone in the chat's going to say, the reason, I don't give a shit. Stop with the 9/10.
Ryan's in for true pricing.
Also,
a dollar store, everything should actually be a dollar.
They're closed.
Every goddamn thing.
They like 99-cent stores like went out of business.
I know. There's still other ones, though. There's like Dollar Trees.
Yeah.
Dollar General.
But the 9/10, no. Like, you're wasting plastic, putting more damn signage up there. Like, just have a price. Like, why is gas different? Like, maybe when it was 40 cents a gallon, it was like 40 9/10.
Yeah.
And now it's like over $5 a gallon. I feel like I went on this rant already. Did I do it on another show? Maybe I did it on – I don't remember.
I don't know. We've reached the point in our podcasting time together where I think we've said everything in our brains at different points now.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have anything left. I've got the same – like, it's like everyone has those people, right? You're like older relatives or friends, Ryan in my case, who just tell you the same story a few times. Mm. And you just have to either politely grin or bear it, or you have to be that dick who's like,
you've told me
this already. And I kind of vary. I kind of go back and forth on what I do. But I'm also becoming that person. Because also sometimes you just can't remember – like sometimes you just are saying the story to the same person for the fourth time and it's just because you're like, you know, early Alzheimer's or whatever. But sometimes it's I can't remember who I spoke spoke these words to, because you're not actually listening to the person's responses. And frankly, they have nothing novel to say because it's your story, and they don't care, and they're not really listening either. So if there's nothing to hang your hook on, you're just saying the same thing again to the same person who's not going to say anything in response, and so it's not novel or interesting.
Hmm.
You know what I mean?
I get you.
So I think there's a couple of options. There's Alzheimer's, or you've got really boring friends who don't provide input.
Yet another Duck fan. 1982 and older are worth twice their face value. So I think he's talking about pennies. I believe it's like 1967 or 70, like for quarters. Like those are really worth – that's silver. So that's actually worth money. And then Amy has a good point. She says she's fine with colored money. Oh, that was the wrong one to pull up there. She's fine with colored money. She's not okay with different sized money. I don't want my – yeah, I want the bills to all be the same size. Not, it doesn't have to be like the same
that's
size.
That's a good point. Yeah. I think I want it to fit in my wallet.
The same way.
Yeah, I don't want it to be weird. Yeah, I think that makes sense. Coins, though, different sizes for sure. Otherwise, how would you know?
Yeah.
But you don't want coins at all anymore.
I mean – probably get rid of pennies. You don't know, a Duck fan, the environmental impact of the 9/10 plastic that never changes versus the actual gasoline being sold. Peak podcast of champions.
I love it.
Yeah. Get rid of the 9/10, people.
Why are you ever going to the gas station?
I do have a classic car in the garage that I...
You're a car guy?
No, I just have one.
You just have a classic car, but you are not, in fact, a car guy.
I'm not a big car guy, but I... Yeah, kind of grew up with it. My parents got one. It's a 1966 Corvette Stingray that we got to drive in high school. Nothing worked on it. Like, you'd put the turn signal on, the radio would shut off. We'd run out of gas. Like, the odometer didn't work, the gas, you know, all that kind of stuff. And but we lived in New England, and it would just stay in the garage all the time. And I helped my little brother buy his first condo, and my parents were like, you know, why don't we just ship the Corvette out to you? So I'm like, okay. So we've had it like since like early 80s or something. I mean, it was like a $5,000 car or something back then. So I've fixed it up a little bit and stuff, but I don't get on it and work and, you know, I'm not changing the oil and stuff. I have like a Corvette guy. I just drive it around a couple times a month. It's fun. People like stop you and want to like talk about it and stuff, but I would not say I'm a car guy, but I do have to get gas in that.
Mm.
But I like it. You haven't seen that, the Vet?
I mean, I think I've seen it. I just wanted you to tell the story.
Oh.
I've heard it before.
You have? Okay. It's fun.
Yeah. I mean, I provided no input, so you were like, I've never said this to him before.
Yeah. So I have to go to the gas station every once in a while for that.
Mm, okay. And you go often enough, clearly, that it incenses you.
Nah, it's just one of those weird
things. See, I don't pay attention to things like that, like the 9/10.
Yeah.
No. I'm more incensed by, I mean, not to build on yet another Duck fan's point, but that there are gas stations at all, and that we aren't all already driving very affordable electric cars. Like, it's crazy that that hasn't happened. Like, it's crazy. It's actually crazy. It's obviously because we have a huge oil industry and yada, yada, yada. And I live in a town literally called El Segundo because of the fucking oil refinery there. But
yes. So you're a huge supporter of that.
I am a huge supporter.
It is funny that
they were a huge supporter of my education.
There's like a refinery like in your backyard, and our gas prices are the most expensive in the nation. Like, literally, it's being made right here.
The Chevron on Main Street in El Segundo, which is like not quite spitting distance, but maybe pissing distance from the refinery.
Yeah, you could hit like a 9-iron and
get the refinery. That's the most expensive gas, I think, in Southern California. It's absolutely insane.
There's a shell.
There should be a direct pipeline. And also, like, you are pumping carcinogens into my lungs every day of not my entire life, because I lived in Georgia for a while and at UCLA for a while, but like, let's say 30 years. I should get free gas. Cause like, you've pumped like the black tar into my lungs for 30 of those years.
Yeah.
I don't get free gas. No?
No.
And then I got Hyperion on the beach where they're just refining shit all day. Like, literally refining poop. And sometimes they'll just let it out and you just smell it. Like El Segundo, the home prices are absolutely insane. Luckily, yes. I inherited my parents' house, but the home prices are absolutely insane. And once a week, or more, you just have to smell a cloud of shit rolling through your yard.
And airplanes flying
And
overhead.
Airplanes flying overhead, carcinogens being pumped out of the refinery, and shit smell.
If you do have any sort of hazardous, you know, like if old paint cans or like oil or whatever, you can always bring it to the Hyperion on the weekends.
Yeah, so they can take it down and break it down and refine it along with the shit and pump it into the air and make you breathe it.
Apparently the water, so they have to take it, there's a lot of water intake and for whatever processes they use, but to put the water back in the ocean, and it's right on the ocean. So this is like oceanfront property if you're not familiar with this area of Southern California. It's kind of an eyesore, but I believe the water that they take in to cool everything and then put back is like a lot cleaner than what the ocean water that they pull in. They have to like treat the water to like actually stick it back in the ocean. Yeah, no.
Like it's, I'm sure that's true because the extent to which they clean that water is ever present in the air in El Segundo. I came home the other day and it was like a thickness in the air. Like where you like, you walk into the bathroom and you're like, I should probably take a shower because I think my entire skin is covered with a thin layer of shit now.
Yeah.
Anyway, great place to live. Great schools.
Colt says is a proud El Segundo resident, embrace the suck. And he said, but the shit pipe surf break is sweet. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's a bunch of surfers there. Yeah. I go fishing over there sometimes too, because it's called the pipe. You know,
yeah,
it's
you can get a lot of three-eyed fish there.
No, I mean, there's a pipe, but it's basically anything under the water that's like kind of a structure. Sometimes they'll dump whatever. Like structures under there, usually there's some kind of life, and then you get, you know, the fishing is pretty good. But along the pipe that comes out from the plant, you can there's some good fishing there sometimes because it creates some kind of structure, and then different, you know, fish will live there and stuff, like bait fish will hide there, so that means bigger fish will come around. So that structure of the actual pipe like creates like a ecosystem down there that makes good fishing.
Somebody should get together some data on cancer rates in El Segundo, California, and then put together some sort of class action. And all of them, Hyperion, fucking refinery, and the airport, all get dinged for it. There's, I want to see lot. It happen.
And it is, you know, you would think El Segundo is cheaper because of all that stuff. And it's,
no, it is so fucking expensive.
But it's right next to Manhattan Beach, which is super expensive.
Yeah, know, like, I mean, it's not as expensive as Manhattan Beach. And I think the biggest reason is.
Yeah, yeah.
Because El Segundo, if you like go there, it's like fucking Mayberry. Like it's just.
You do feel like you're a small
pure
town.
Pure residential. Like it's like if it didn't have Refinery, if it didn't have Hyperion, and if it didn't have LAX, it would be. I mean, I think every house would be like $2.5 million. Like, I think it would be insane.
Yeah.
So it is something that helps to depress the home prices, but goddamn, I think like probably shaving like 8 to 10 off your life living there.
This is a completely off the rails like podcast. Like we're like for the last 30 minutes, I don't think we talked about nothing. Like this is, it's like a Seinfeld episode. I don't know what the fuck. It's like people are gonna listen to like I know the Pac-12's dead, but like try, you know, like,
did you guys fucking kill it?
Maybe you were the best Pac-12 podcast. That's why the conference is dead. Yes.
Yeah.
We were the only one for a while, so
yeah.
Oh, Colt Bush says defending Little League World Series champions El Segundo. So
that's true. That's true.
Yeah. Good stuff. And you do see those tankers out there, you know, because the refinery. Mm-hmm. They're bringing oil to the refinery. Right?
Yeah, they're so bringing the raw crude.
Yeah.
And then it's refined here and then piped out, I think, for the most part. Or trained out. Don't they sell that train?
There's a train, but I don't think it used it often. But yeah, you'll see the outside, you know, airplanes flying over. So the ocean, beautiful. Like airplane, the Dockweiler Beach, you know, airplanes flying over. And then you these tankers out there. If you see the tanker like super high up, it's there basically empty, and then you see them like way down, you know, low, then they're like still full of oil and they've got to pump them in. And they have those big pipes come out and they like dredge, and there's all these little support boats. It's kind of crazy. It's a little weird thing. And then the invite, like what would the neighborhood be if you drive down, was it Culver Boulevard or what's the
Sepulveda?
Not Sepulveda, like the one near the water. So that's Highland turns into, I think it's Culver, right? Culver Boulevard or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And you're – so, you know, you got the Dockweiler beaches on your left. You look to your right. This is like Southern California history or whatever. And you see like the foundations of all these homes that are like, you know, formerly like beachfront homes and stuff, but the LAX is there. So they had to like just it's gone. So they've been gone for like 70 years or whatever it is. But you can still see like some of the streets that are grown over with, you know, weeds and stuff and foundations of the old houses. Like that was like a full on neighborhood that was like oceanfront. And they put LAX there and they're like, nope, get rid of all these things. Had to like bulldoze everything. And but you can still see sort of the remnants of, you know, the skeleton of that neighborhood from way back in the day, which would be super expensive right now. You know, whatever you sold your house for back 70 years ago or whatever it was, you got to be kicking yourself.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about that area?
No, not that area.
You've seen it though, right? When you go by there.
Yeah. Well, and there's the like little blue butterfly preserve they've got on the other side of that. Yeah, I mean, there's a whole bunch of dumb shit. But I guess going back to the main thesis, all that stuff should be blown up. Not literally. That would be terroristic.
That would probably hurt.
but taken down. And we should all be driving electric cars.
Yeah.
It's very stupid.
Rick says there's a pipeline under Rosecrans that feeds the refineries in Long Beach.
That's great.
Oh, interesting. There's, I mean, literally, right. So if you're watching us YouTube, right behind me, there's a power plant that you can see if we move the things over that's getting decommissioned. It was like an overflow power plant. Eyesore here, you know, it's on the water and everything. It's going to take probably decades for all the environmental stuff for them to like tear it down and whatever they're going to build. But they're getting rid of that one. But it was like, I think it's like one of those ones. They have like emergency plants that if the grid gets too taxed, you would fire up this, but they hardly ever use it. So there's smokestacks and everything right on the water. So there'll be some sort of development there, but probably by the time it's done, I'll probably be dead.
You know what's crazy about power plants?
This is really off the rails. Yep.
Do you know what's crazy about power plants? Is basically every single fucking one of them, it's just a new and exciting way to heat water to make steam. Like that's all we're doing. All we are doing is using steam power from like the early 1800s. Like we haven't figured out anything else. It's like no. This is just a much better way to get the water really hot to make steam. Nuclear power? No, we're just making steam. It's so like, what are we doing? No innovation.
I don't know.
But it should all be nuclear power if we're going to do these stupid power plants.
Yeah, like if you're playing SimCity, the nuclear power one's better. But you two get, you know, every
then
once
you
in a
can
while,
do the then it, you can do the really innovative fusion power.
Oh
yeah. Don't do the fission power. That's dirty.
I haven't played
it since SimCity 2000.
Wow, it's been a while.
2000.
Yeah, Colt wants to hear your thoughts on nuclear energy. He just said he's pro nukes.
Well, I think as it stands right now, to get where we need to be, you need to use it. Now, in the long run, in the fullness of time, ideally, you get solar energy to a point, wind energy to a point, offshore wind energy to a point that you don't need it anymore. But I think for now, you got to have a healthy amount of nuclear capacity. And it's generally, I mean, look, obviously, Chernobyl, not so great. But it's generally pretty safe. Like it's, you know, most of the time that doesn't happen.
There was a funny Simpsons one where like they have like a minor meltdown at the plant and like Homer saves them because he's too fat and like falls in the thing. He's like, we turned what could have been a Chernobyl into a mere 3 mile island. You know, it's pretty funny. It was pretty good. But all right, well, we should probably wrap it up because I don't know what they're.
We've gotten to nuclear energy.
I had another thought, and I'm like, I don't want to like, and I forgot what it is because my brain's not. With nuclear energy, what we're doing, all that stuff.
Are you a nuclear guy?
Oh, I try to say the way my former president said it. No, I don't remember.
My former president. Nuclear? I think you said nuclear.
Nuclear, yeah.
You say nuclear.
Sometimes, I think, yeah.
Okay.
What do you say?
Nuclear?
Nuclear, yeah. I think I go back and forth.
Hmm.
Nuclear or nuclear? Yeah.
Nuclear?
Nuclear. Nuclear. I'm going to make it sound weird. I don't know.
Nuclear.
What were we saying? There was another one we were saying too. We got to stop this. There was like a New England saying, like something like it would, I forget what it was. You kind of grew up.
What, the three different Marys?
No.
How there's Mary the name and then Mary and you pronounce them all differently, but here in Southern California, we all pronounce them the same.
Oh, I didn't realize
like
that.
You do Merry Christmas, and that's something, and then Mary somebody is something else, and then Mary the name is something else.
Oh, yeah.
But like,
here it sounds the same.
We all do it the same.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fun.
Yeah, we're getting interesting now.
Matt Preem, Duck Territory. Thank you so much for coming on.
An hour ago.
That seemed like a long time ago before this went completely off the rails. I got my new 247 shirt. Do you like my light blue?
Yeah, it's very
nice. You know, I had like a light green one. I could have wore that for the Oregon day because I wore like purple for Washington day. But I got a, you know, I don't have enough 247 shirts, so I had to buy some more. Because I just like them. I don't know. All right. Let's go wrap it up. For David Woods, I am Ryan Abraham. Hope you guys enjoy the show, and we will talk to you next time.
Goodbye.